Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Porto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Porto.
Hello, welcome everybody. This is Robert Porto for Mushing Radio, and we're continuing our Musher series tonight. And we have calling in a dog food expert. If you know anything about mushing dog food, you've probably heard of Dr. Timms. And that's who we're speaking with today. Doctor, how are you?
Pretty good, Robert. How are you up there today?
Fine, thank you. I know it is late over there on your side of the world, and thanks for calling in so late for us. If you could, introduce yourself, tell our listeners who you are and what you're all about.
Sure. Name's Tim Hunt. I live in Michigan, Upper Michigan, up in the Upper Peninsula. I've been running sled dogs since about 93, and that's what really got me into the whole nutritional spectrum is the understanding that nutrition plays such a big part with the dogs. I just didn't quite realize that. And vets, you know, as a rule, aren't the best person on nutrition, and where I learned all my stuff is just working with these racing dogs for many years and seeing what a difference good food can make. And it propelled us down the trail. We've been able to travel all over the world racing dogs and meeting people and enjoying ourselves with our dogs ahead of us.
You know, I definitely want to talk about the Momentum brand of your guys' dog food. But before we do that, let's tell our listeners about your other brands first. I know you do everything from, you know, your typical pet dog food all the way to cat food as well.
Yeah, exactly. We kind of look at dog food as a purpose food. What's the dog doing for a lifestyle? So we have the highly active dog, the Momentum, or dog food, the Momentum, like you mentioned. Next one down is Pursuit, which is a 30-20, which isn't necessarily meant for the sled dog as a only dry food type supplement, but used a lot with active dogs or with meat supplementation. And then we have Kinesis, which is a dog food for the couch potato kind of style, or a dog that doesn't do much more than run around the backyard. We have a cat food as well that we brought out, and the whole premise with all of our foods in a short story is the fact that we use multiple animal protein sources to try to amount for most of our protein in the food. So instead of using any plant proteins to bring our numbers up, we use primarily animal proteins, averaging nearly 90% of all our proteins are coming from another animal, be it salmon, herring, chicken, or whatever. And the cat food goes the same way. Dogs and cats, for that matter, they just flourish on a lot of animal protein going into them. That's what they're meant to eat.
You know, when you go to a feed store anywhere in the country, just like in any grocery store that we enter as Americans, we're bombarded by choices. And everything is in the fancy bags and, you know, the cute little puppy pictures or whatever's on the bag. Can you give some advice? Of course, promote your food as you wish, but can you give some advice to, you know, the basic pet owner? They walk in that feed store and they see 50 different types of food, and one of them usually catches their eye, and they don't know a whole lot about it. Just that, you know, they're just gravitated towards that for whatever reason. Can you give maybe an education in consumer picking of dog food for us?
Sure. I think a lot of foods are actually made with marketing in mind as to what target group they're trying to hit, be it, you know, one type of dog owner, what they do for a living, where they live in the country, and so on. So marketing is something that definitely catches your eye in that marketplace versus the ingredients in the bag. So once they kind of hook you with the bait and then bringing you over to buy the bag of dog food is usually what happens. But if you want to try to be more informed and educated, what I tend to tell people to look at is, number one, we look at the multiple animal sources of protein that go into it, I think are really important. Two, look at the ASH level of the food. I think that denotes the quality of a food much quicker than almost anything else. And that if you can find a food that actually lists an ASH content and it's reasonably low, you can then be guaranteed that we're having mainly high-quality animal protein sources going into it. So I think that's important as well. I think doing some research on the food before you go in, or if you see one out on the Internet, will really help to see how things are reviewed and what people's opinions are versus just blindly grabbing it. But we're trying to feed the animals the best we can. And like you say, I walk into a store and I get hit by 50 different foods, what is it that I'm really trying to drive my purchase on? And really those are some of the things to look at. The last thing I would say is really look to see if a food has a high level of omega-3 fatty acids that's derived from fish. Makes a huge difference with an animal, be it a dog or a cat. And if we can find one that's in a higher range with the omega-3s already in the food, I think you're going to find a higher quality food.
You know, before we get into the mushing part of it, you know, that's our primary audience, of course. But, you know, you always hear the basic numbers, the 30-20s, the 35-25s, when you're talking about fat and protein and fat. What does that mean in terms of, you know, you're looking at a bag of kibble there, it's you know, the little kernels or whatever they are. What do those numbers mean to the average person?
They don't mean anything. You know, the numbers, they're not sure what they mean, so they would have to do their research as to what those numbers really denote. So if the company has it together and they have these numbers on there, they're going to tell you what that is for. You know, what's the purpose of a 30-20? It's going to be an active dog as a typical rule. Now, something lower than that would be more directed towards an all-life stage or an adult-type dog food, for that matter. I think looking at those numbers is important when you're trying to base a formulation for a sled dog, let alone any sort of active dog, and that certain percentages of calories need to especially be derived from fat and protein and such. So with a mushing field, it's a lot easier to explain to a person than the average Joe.
Great analysis there. You know, you often hear dog foods, especially that are high in that protein number and that high fat number, you often hear of them as rocket fuel for dogs, especially those pet dogs. And if you put them on one of those really high potency foods, they tend to cause a little bit of an energy boost for those dogs. Do you recommend appropriate numbers for, you know, the average dog? You're talking about those 30-20 numbers for that active dog. What about the dog, you know, your typical pet that's laying around the house with you watching Monday Night Football at your feet?
Sure. You know, I think those dogs do great on those higher fat protein numbers. The biggest problem is portion control.
Right.
Here in the United States, everybody measures by volume as a rule. And when you get away from the States, be it Europe or even Canada for that matter, you're going to start to see people measuring by weight. And I actually usually see much more fit dogs in those areas because they're measuring by weight, which is a much better accurate method of delivering the calories to the dog, is how much we're giving them to, or how much food we're giving to that one dog. So if we can give less of a higher protein fat food, what I find is, one, we can definitely control their weight. Two, they definitely feel like they want to do something. They feel more active. And it's not because the food's loaded with caffeine. It's just hitting the numbers that make their cells work right, and then they feel it. And it's very similar to eating a bunch of quarter pounders for a while and you feel pretty sluggish, or donuts, and then eating some really good, steaks for that matter, and then you feel alive again. So I think we can do the same with our animals.
And of course,
it's all about portion control.
Exactly. And the way that it's prepared is also a concern to a lot of folks. You know, a lot of people add water to dry kibble or don't add water, and sometimes the particular kibbles should require that. What about that preparation? Because, you know, like most folks, they aren't reading the bags. They just, you know, put their scooper in after they get it home and, you know, dump in the portion that they think is right and be done with it. What do you have to say about your food in terms of preparation? Is it just one of those scoop and let go, or is there something, some magical quest there?
Well, with the momentum, it really, making that food originally stemmed from making a witch's brew in my garage for many years in a cement mixer. We've all done that as a musher. We put everything in there but the kitchen sink, more or less, trying to make that special fuel. To me, what I decided to do instead of all that work, putting each piece in there every night with all this meat that I was doing and wheat germ oil and all that malarkey, I just decided to put it all into a kibble. So I had to supplement very little after that. And to me, everything's in that food that I need for my racing dogs except for raw meat. And I still believe we need to bring meat into the equation with these racing dogs as a rule. There's some exceptions here and there, but I just see the benefit of raw food going into these racing dogs. But we can cut down a great, great deal on how much we need to feed of that meat with a food that's high quality like this or several others that are out in the market that are similar.
Well, let's get into the sled dog conversation if we can, Doctor. Talking to Dr. Tim tonight here on Mushing Radio on KVRF and mushingradio.com. We're heading over in to talk about some pretty high-quality mushing kibble, Dr. Tim's Momentum. Describe that in a nutshell in regards to your other brands. You said that's for the sled dog, for the very active dog. I'm sure you're thinking of agility dogs and other type of working dog, maybe search and rescue type dogs. What is that food geared towards, and should the average consumer buy that for their pet dog?
Yeah, I think so. I think, again, it comes down to feeding the right amount. But when I feed one of these foods to a dog that isn't necessarily doing too much, they do definitely feel like they want to do something more, and hopefully that'll get the owner out the door a little quicker. Dogs will eat to what they need calorically if given the chance, and when I'm looking at trying to feed one of these higher-fat foods, that really dogs are meant to be fed high-fat foods, period, be it a dachshund or a sled dog, they really aren't that dissimilar. It's just the number of calories that we're supposed to deliver to them on a daily basis. But when we do that correctly, we could just get a much healthier dog long term. And those fatty acids make a huge difference, especially the fish oil stuff that really benefits them in so many ways, from as simply as noticing their coat gets better in a few weeks to the long term benefits of the antioxidants and omega-3 fatty acids on their insides that we can't actually quite touch.
So you're also a musher, and I'm sure years and years of, like you said, those trials and tribulations out there in the garage with the mixing bowls and the ladles and the axes and everything out there, you finally came up with your secret formula at that time. You know, every musher has that in their back pocket, and some of them don't want to share it. You know, that's a very personal thing to a lot of kennels. If we can, before we get into that, maybe give us a little bit of a history in terms of what you've done in mushing. Are you a long distance musher, a sprint musher, recreational musher? What type of dogs do you work with?
Sure. I started off as a mid distance musher, did that for many years, doing 200 and 300 mile races in the Midwest. We did some racing up in Canada. We were lucky enough to go to Europe 3 times and race in the Grand Odyssey, which is about a 400-mile stage race in the Alps. We've raced the Wyoming Stage Stop a few times, and we ran the Iditarod a few years back as well. So I've kind of dabbled in everything but sprint mushing. I prefer to be out on a sled a longer time with my dogs, and I like to camp. So to me, if I'm going to go for a run, I'd rather make it long enough so I can relax, which is usually 4 or 5 hours at a stretch, as you know. What it's like to be out there, and then taking a break in between at a camp is a good time. So I tend to look at races that way these days. But to me, I've always said if someone's willing to put a trail in a place I've wanted to see, the best way to do it is by a dog team. So if I can travel from one place to another in the mountain range via dog team, I'm all for it. It's not always about trying to win a race for me. To me, it's about being out there in those environments. And, of course, the competition is fun. I do enjoy that and have great friendships with a lot of good mushers out there. And I've been lucky enough to learn a lot about nutrition from these wonderful mushers that I've come across in different parts of the world. So it's kind of not one special formula I put together here. It's a gathering of facts from many mushers out there that have put it together without even knowing what they've done, except they know it works. And, you know, looking at that and breaking it out and trying to make a kibble to try to simplify it so we don't have to do all this mixing and matching in our own garages. So I've really enjoyed my mushing career. It's been fun. It's opened a lot of doors I never expected, and I've met great people up your way up in Alaska.
So tell us about, you mentioned Europe a little bit ago, talking to Dr. Tim Hunt today and his dog food company, Dr. Tim's, and the various brands. You mentioned how they do things a little bit differently over there. I don't have a lot of experience with European mushers, and of course now it's blossoming in Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and all other places. How do they do things a little bit different than we do in the U.S.?
Oh, it's just dangerous. They just do it really dangerous. They like ski slopes and putting you up and down, really tough terrain that way at huge angles. You know, there's not a lot of private land, or public land, I should say, that you can get through a lot of Europe, so you have to resort to private areas, which tends to be ski slopes, which tend to interconnect, so you're kind of running those terrains. And it's usually at night because the ski slopes are all loaded up during the day, so you're doing night racing in the mountains, which can be very exciting or very, you know, harrowing. So, you know, it was an interesting thing. The French sure know how to cook. The food was great. The wine was great. The racing was tenuous, and there's a few mushers in Alaska that have done that race, and they can probably tell you the same thing.
Nothing like heading down a Black Diamond course with a 12-dog team, huh?
No, it's nothing like that. It's really fast, and you're just hanging on, and really it's not much choice except to hold that brake down, and, you know, that's when you start to talk to the man up in the sky a little bit.
So what do you think the future of mushing is? You know, it's been around for a long time, but like I said, it's growing throughout the world. How do you see it, at least from your company's perspective? How do you think it's growing or kind of leveling off? What do you think?
No, I think it's growing, but in smaller kennels. The kennels aren't nearly as big as what I've seen in various parts of the world, so I think it's more of a smaller kennel development. The bigger kennels are still out there, but I don't see a lot of big kennels popping up suddenly, or at least I'm not aware of it. But I think it's going to spread out in more controlled, smaller races with smaller kennels involved, and I think that's healthy because, you know, it's just like playing baseball. You play baseball with your friends, but you ultimately love to go to see the big pro teams at the, you know, Major League Baseball parks, be it you mush yourself and then you take a trip to go watch the Iditarod start or one of those races like that. So it doesn't mean they're going to participate in it, but they look up to their idols like that, and I think that's healthy for the whole sport is to have those smaller kennels slowly pop up here and there and have it controllable so they don't get crazy with too many dogs, and then suddenly they realize they don't like the sport, and they have these dogs, and what do we do with it? So, to me, I think that's a healthy development with the sport.
What about the development of the sport in relation to places that don't have snow? When you think of South Africa and parts of Australia and things where they don't have snow, but they're doing a lot of gig racing or kart racing, whatever it's called in those parts of the world, do you see that that's growing in popularity a little bit better than you know, your typical snow and sled type mushing?
That's a great question. You know, I'm not sure if I'm the best person to ask that question. I've talked to some folks that have traveled to those areas. And I think any time you can take a dog and put it into an athletic setting and it has something that's genetically there to make them do that or make them want to do that, be it a dog that pulls and runs fast and they're bred for that type of an environment, I'm all for it. I think it's great. You take a big furry dog from Alaska and go try to run it fast in New Zealand in the desert, that wouldn't be necessarily the best thing. But, no, I think it spurs interest, and with the right dogs meant for that climate, why not?
Sure. Let's talk about feeding of sled dogs. Of course, we have a lot of very professional mushers that listen to the show, but a heck of a lot of rookies. You know, the recreational musher, the guy and gal that has a couple of dogs in the backyard that they do want to go run a race or two, but maybe have the dreams of the Iditarod someday, but they often mess up on the food. They often look at what the big boys are doing, you know, the Martin Boosters, the Jeff Kings, the Lance Mackeys, and, you know, they jump on the bandwagon of feeding whatever they're feeding, and they may or may not be doing it right because they don't have a lot of education in what they should feed and how they should feed. Could you give some advice to those very novice-type mushers that don't quite know exactly what they should be doing and they want to do it right anyway?
Sure. First things for them or for anyone to realize is that dogs, nutrition is number one in the whole scheme of training up a team. It goes nutrition, the actual training, and then the genetics of the dog. And I'll see people kind of grasp at any one of those three. But to me, figuring out the whole food idea really starts the whole ball moving. And a couple of things to realize are, they make foods out there for sporting dogs for a reason. They're built a certain way, the food is, to accommodate for the different stresses those athletic dogs are going to go underneath. So don't try to make a food that's not built or made for that kind of a dog into a dog food that's going to actually perform well in that setting. So you can really fail that way by trying to use some food meant for the couch potato dog and try to bring it into an athletic endeavor. It's just not going to work very well. Number two, I think people need to realize what is a dog that is in shape, and what that means is as simply as being able to touch over the ribs and still feeling some ribs. What I often see with novices is they tend to feed heavy, thinking the food's going to be the bullet to make the dog go faster, and in essence, we usually end up with a chubby dog. And, hey, I'm the same guy as the other person that loves their dog to death, and I fed dogs till they're a little too chubby because I feel sorry for them or whatever it might be. But with the novices and all of us, for that matter, just remember to touch the dog. And just as important as finding the dog being too fat in that we can't feel their ribs, there's a lot of dogs when you actually touch them, especially as we get into this time of the year, where suddenly they're very, very ribby, but we didn't notice it because, well, dogs, be it a pro like Mr. King or the new guy in the block, we all fall prey to that one and that we forget. To me, that's the best way to monitor a dog's weight and see it properly. So it really does all start at the back end of the dog with how the food's going to perform, meaning that stools need to stay consistent and fairly solid or solid through the course of training. And if we're not getting that, then something's not right. And that's when you talk to someone out there that's been in the game for a while. Drop a note to someone that you're trying to emulate or someone that might have more experience than that yourself, and maybe they can answer there and meant to be used in that setting.
Great advice. Talking to Dr. Tim Hunt, to the house cat as well. Doctor, you had talked about that it's not necessarily rocket science, but one thing that caught my Dee Dee Genro on the show earlier this summer, she said that no matter what, she feeds the dogs the same exact food in the summer as she does in the winter. She's a big proponent of feeding that same kibble all year long and not switching the diet from summer diet to winter diet, so on and so forth. And she said something that has stuck with a lot of mushers. We've had this comment a lot from our listeners. She says that your dogs are what they ate 6 months ago. And, of course, that's coming from a very accomplished musher, been in Iditarod for a long time. What is your take on that statement?
Yeah, I think she's right on. I agree with her 100%. You feed the same food year-round, you just change your portion in the summer versus winter. Not only does a dog acclimate to increasing stressors of training through the fall, as you're increasing your mileage or weight or whatever you're doing, their metabolism also has to adjust to food changes. So if you change your food over to a racing diet, you know, the 1st of September, and you're starting training the 1st of September, you're putting two tremendous stresses on this dog. To me, metabolically, if you adjust a food, or a dog, I should say, over to a higher fat food at least 2 months ahead of training, you know, then they have time to catch up to that new food. 6 months is even better. So to me, the best thing to do is if you keep them on the same high fat food year round, metabolically, at the levels of their mitochondria, those little mitochondria have already adapted over to the high fat. So when you go into training, they're ready to roll with increasing the amount of food, not having to adjust to suddenly a new high fat food. So she's right. So to me, it's at the real cellular level that makes the difference of keeping them on this food year round. And it's really all about the level of the mitochondria of the cell. And not trying to get into a whole big science lingo here, but the mitochondria are basically the little furnaces that run the cell. And if you can make those furnaces very efficient by fueling those little furnaces with fuel oil, I'm losing my voice, if you fuel them with fuel oil, which is fat, versus logs of wood, which is carbohydrate, they work way, way better. And then your dog responds. And one last thing, I'm getting winded here, is that when you do these high-fat meals year-round, you can really bring your training curve quicker in the fall than you've ever seen before. I noticed it myself that training seemed to go up by at least a month. I always say you can shave a month off fall training if you have these high-fat meals going through the summer. She's got it. Dee Dee knows what she's doing.
Very, very good. I know it's late there in Michigan. I know you're a musher. You've probably been working since early this morning. We just have a few minutes to go, if you don't mind. Dr. Tim Hunt, we're talking to you tonight here on Mushing Radio. Another common mistake, especially with the novices and the rookies, is they'll get to a race and they want to make sure that appearances are appropriate. And then, you know, they go from whatever they're feeding in the yard up until the day of the race, and here they show up with, the magic formula, whether it be the kibble or the particular mix. And, of course, that backfires on them, literally, on the trail. What can you give as an advice to those folks that, want to look good to their peers in the community, but also, it kind of backfires on them as well?
Yeah, they're looking for the magic bullet. We've all been there, the magic beaver balls or whatever it is that you bring out the Saturday morning before the race. to me, racing is all about training, and you get all those kind of things done in the training time that you put out with your dogs, be it your feeding schedules, your watering schedules, the treats or supplements you might give during, before, after the race. You get it through in training. Never bring anything new into the point when you're going to race. Never change anything going into a race. No new sleds, no new harnesses, no new food, because it just leads to disaster, and food is one thing that can sure do it. So to me, your best place to train a dog is really in the dog yard, and that's all about feeding them and getting them to do something when you feed them and then making them want to eat. And then if you have a dog team that wants to eat, you're already nine-tenths of the way down the trail to that finish point, and feeding a dog and getting to eat when you need them to is just key. So, you know, newbie, oldie, whatever it is, teaching a dog team to eat is the way to go, but you don't try anything or experiment with anything new for that race. I think you're just asking for trouble.
And you know, that's a great advice, and that's advice for a lot of us up-and-coming mushers. A good friend of mine, Dave Shear, had said on this show, he said, race as you train. And I think that's very good advice. You know, do the same exact thing that you're doing in training during that race, and don't deviate at all. Just make sure it's like a training run. It doesn't have, whether it's the Iditarod, the Yukon Quest, or whatever. You have the miles. Get out there and just do it like you're training.
You know, one thing that really helps everybody is to try to always remember that great run you had, wherever it might have been, training, race, whatever. And if you can picture that in your mind over and over, the night before race, you know, or during training for that matter, go to sleep thinking about that terrific run. And the power of positive thinking is amazing. And, you know, it all goes together. You try to get your mind in the right place. You try to get the dogs in the right place via training that's correct or proper. You know, the right nutrition, the right dogs. All of that comes together. But the positive thinking really works. So try to, you know, really zero in on those great runs you had. And you go through it in your brain enough, it's amazing how that'll just carry through to success.
Awesome stuff. Doctor, I have one final question for you. It's actually a question from a listener. On our other show, Dog Works Radio, it's more of a dog training show, not necessarily a mushing show. We've had a lot of conversations with folks about raw diets. And, of course, mushers, a lot of their diet is that raw meat, that fat, and all those things that we add to those buckets with the kibble as well. But what do you think as a dog food company owner about the fads in, you know, today's society with everything going raw, you know, whether it's home prepared or these diets that you can buy at the store that you cut up into chunks, very similar to the way that we do it in the mushing kennels. What do you think about that fad these days where everybody's expecting everybody to have their pets on that raw diet?
Well, I think the raw diet's good in the right people's hands. You know, we look at our example of sled dog mushing. One could say we're primarily raw feeders, for that matter, as we go along the trail of, you know, trying to be successful. So there's a whole bunch of meat that we put into our dogs. As a general rule, for the average person feeding their animal raw food, they have one dog. If they do their research, you can sure do it right, and it can be very successful. And I have those dogs come through my practice, and those dogs look really good. You know, they're very healthy animals. There's a lot to be said about that raw-based diet. Balancing it out is not that difficult. It's pretty simple. Where I see it fail is usually people get tired of doing it after about 3 or 4 months. It's like mushing, feeding raw for 20 years. Think of all those hours you spend at your meat saw. I mean, it's a lot. One person doing one dog, and they get tired after 3 months, yet we were feeding 50 dogs for 10 years. I mean, they're wimps, huh?
They are. And with that, we're just out of time. Dr.
Right.
Tim Hunt, drtims.com is the website. We'll make sure we pass over some links to you as well, okay?
Pleasure talking to you, Robert. You have a good night, and hello, everyone in Alaska. Take care. I'm glad you're getting some snow.
Thank you very much. Dr. Tim, we'll talk again soon. Goodbye.